Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Despite growing political divisions and declining trust in our politicians, most Americans are confident that our democratic system, the American Republic, will endure. And so do Europeans. They trust that their democratic governments are resilient, even as many are expressing less faith in democracy in general. How confident should we be? Could we go through successions of republics as France has, or could the American Republic go the way that Rome's did over 2,000 years ago when it came to a turbulent end with at 482 years before it fell? Award-winning, it came to a turbulent end with the rise of an autocrat. Rome's Republic had endured 482 years before it fell. Award-winning University of California, San Diego historian Edward J. Watts examines the decline of the Roman Republic and considers some possible parallels for our times in his new book called Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. It's from Basic Books, and I'm pleased that it has brought Professor Watts to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What might we learn from Republican Rome and its decline, even though it's over 2,000 years past?
Well, I think the most important place to start is that the founding fathers of the United States looked to Rome as the example on which they patterned our Constitution. And the basic, I think, impulse for that was a understanding that in Rome, what you had were very successful structures for facilitating compromise and avoiding dangerous conflict that resulted in, you know, ultimately in political violence. And Rome was very good at creating structures that worked that way. And that's what we have largely imitated. And the basic sort of infrastructure of our democracy is lifted in large part from what Rome did. But the lesson that we see in the Roman context is, in a sense, the Roman Republic was too successful. And people began to take for granted the stability that it promised. If you were a Roman in, say, 150 BC, and you were looking around the world, you would see that you live in a society that's basically free from violent political conflict, where just about everybody else around the world is engaging in violence and political sort of turmoil. And this created a kind of arrogance among the Romans that they could assume that the Republic was robust enough to withstand anything, you know, any sort of game playing or any sort of norm breaking that they wanted to engage in. And I think this is one of the challenges the U.S. is facing right now. And we, too, as you said in the opening, believe that our Republic will endure because it has endured. And that fundamentally, I think the Romans show us, is a mistake.
Well, in the last century, politics turned violent. The Senate was involved in that. Many legislatures have Senates. What did the architects of modern democracies adopt from the Roman system beyond using that name?
So I think the notion of the Senate is an important one, because in Rome, what the Senate represented was a group of advisors, largely, you know, the word Senate actually comes from the Latin senex, which means old person. And the Roman Senate was a group of experienced administrators and former magistrates who were supposed to be consulted on matters of policy. And what they effectively served to do is the same thing that our Senate once upon a time was supposed to do as well. You know, the famous comment that the Senate is the saucer where the tea of the House of Representatives sort of goes to cool. This is what the Romans thought as well. You know, the ideas that were popular in gaining support in the sort of general populace in Rome would go to the Senate and be sort of vetted. But as you move into this period of turmoil in the second century BC, what you see are senators responding with violence and sort of organized violence against opponents who they felt had become powerful enough that they could sort of work around the senatorial check.
To the point of killing them and killing their followers.
Exactly. This began in the 130s. And what I think is a challenge for us is to understand when violence erupts in Rome, it never goes away, but it takes a while to come back, at least initially. And so the first senatorial murder of a popular politician occurs in 133. The next one doesn't occur until the 120s. And the senators who are responsible for this are punished. And one of them actually has to sort of build a massive temple to concord, you know, civic agreement in the Roman Forum as a way to sort of make good for the violence that he perpetuated. But when senators are involved in organizing and perpetuating violence, that fundamentally changes the way political life works in Rome. Because all of a sudden now, being on the wrong side of a political fight doesn't just mean you lose face, it means you lose your life.
Now, you said the Senate was made up of, it's an equivalent of a Congress of elders, but all wealthy?
Yes, though they aren't the wealthiest people in Rome. And this is also something that becomes a challenge in the Republic. There was a property qualification that you had to meet to be in the Senate. And so you did have to be wealthy. But there were a lot of people in Roman society who were wealthier than certain senators. And this, you know, eventually becomes destabilizing because senators start seeing massive gaps between the amount of money that the wealthiest senators and wealthiest Romans possess and what a lot of other senators possess. And this creates friction, not dissimilar to what we see in our society now.
And the founding fathers who knew that, they had restrictions as to who could vote and who could serve in the legislatures. Only people who are property owners. So how is that all that different? Didn't they recognize that they were building into this some serious problems?
Well, this was actually built into the structure of the Roman Republic as well. The Roman Republic, of course, did not extend franchise to everybody. Women couldn't vote. People who did not possess property could vote, but the Republic structured voting in such a way that people who possessed more property belonged to voting groups that were smaller. And so in a sense, the people who were wealthier had proportionally larger voices in the way that the Republic decided things. And what we did was slightly different, but the principle was similar. We outright excluded the votes initially of people who didn't possess property. In Rome, they just diluted those votes to the point where they were essentially meaningless.
Go ahead.
But the principle is the same.
Didn't the Roman Senate endure long after the Republic had ended? Kind of democracy in name, if not in substance?
Yeah, this is the great insight of the first emperor and the second emperor. I think that the insight that they had was for senators, the idea of and the honor of being a senator was sometimes enough. And if you took that away from people entirely, they would be very upset. But a Senate in which people who belonged to families that had long been senatorial families, and here we could think of, I don't know, a family like the Bushes or even the Clintons, where there's a history of service, or the Kennedys, there's a history of service and the expectation is you'll continue to do that. What the first emperors realized was you couldn't take away that possibility of having the sort of name that you served. But you could take away all sort of substantive abilities for people in the Senate to make decisions. And this was a trade-off that most people in the Senate were willing to make. And so what the Senate sort of survives as is a sort of honor that elite people could claim, and they could measure up to the standards of their ancestors. And they were willing to trade that honor for any kind of actual voice in what was going on in Roman society.
Now, when was Rome's Republic established, and what led Romans to institute a democratic system? What did they think a republic or a democracy could do that a monarchy or a dictatorship couldn't?
It's a very interesting question. what Rome started as, at least as early as we can trace it, is it started as a monarchy, but a monarchy in which the king was actually quite weak. And the king was selected from among members of a group of very old elite families called the patricians. And when a king died, there would be a sort of gap where patricians would, in essence, interview for the position, and then one would be chosen. And when he died, again, this process would happen. And so it wasn't a hereditary monarchy. But a series of economic changes in the middle part of the 6th century BC led people to basically sort of usurp this power from patricians and essentially appoint kings who were not sort of checked by the patricians. And the Republic was a patrician reaction against this. But the initial way the Republic was structured was effectively patricians running the Roman state. And that didn't endure within 10 years. You know, this happens in 509 BC. Within about 15 years, the wealthy non-patricians lead a walkout where they, in essence, renegotiate the terms of the Republic. And the Republic becomes something that sort of blends the prerogatives of the hereditary aristocracy, that is the patricians, with the sort of interests of the wealthy non-patricians in Roman society. And this becomes a stable arrangement where over time the things available to the non-patricians become greater. But in essence, you have an alliance and a structural sort of investment in the stability of the Roman state that binds patricians and wealthy non-patricians in a very stable structure that endures for the better part of 500 years.
Did Rome already have an empire when the Republic was established?
No, it was actually quite small. Rome was a city-state. It actually had started, if you go to the city of Rome now and you think of the famous seven hills of the city of Rome, initially many of these were independent settlements that sort of grew into each other and became a kind of agglomeration of settlements that became the city of Rome. And at the time of the foundation of the Republic, Rome controlled an area smaller than Rhode Island. But the Republic was so successful in creating a stable political structure that Rome expanded across Italy and by the beginning of the 3rd century controlled all of Italy. And by the end of the 3rd century, controlled a large Mediterranean empire as well.
That's after the Second Punic War, where they defeated Hannibal in 201 BC. So did they have the same kind of hegemony that the United States enjoyed after World War II?
It's actually quite interesting. After the defeat of Hannibal, the Roman decision was not dissimilar. The Roman decision about what to do next was not dissimilar to what the U.S. did after World War II, where Rome, in essence, pulled back from regions that didn't feel like it wanted to control directly. So it defeated Hannibal and defeated Carthage, but it didn't conquer Carthage. It instead created a structure that sort of bound Carthage in an alliance with Rome. And Rome did a similar thing in the Greek world. Now, the alliance with Carthage endured for about 50 years and then actually sort of worked pretty well for Rome. But in the Greek world, Rome's pulling back from it might be similar to the U.S. decision to pull back from parts of Asia after World War II. Rome just continued to get enmeshed in conflicts in the Greek world for the better part of 60 years and ultimately was sort of compelled to take control of Greece, largely because an alliance structure wasn't working. And Rome had to keep coming back and sort of doing police actions in Greece because its alliance structure didn't work. And so the model that Rome wanted to follow after the Second Punic War is similar to the model the U.S. wanted to follow after World War II.
But complicating it all is the fact that Greece had, they say that once you go south of Naples, you're in Greece. In Italy, so there were. You find Greek ruins in the south. It gets very complicated. The two cultures are similar, but also rather dissimilar.
Yeah, so southern Italy, south of Naples, along the coast, is old Greek colonies that had been set up by cities as diverse as, you know, Sparta and Megara, but. These had historically been Greek, and Rome had absorbed them in the course of the 4th century BC. And then it absorbed Sicily, which was half Greek and half basically Phoenician. And it absorbed Sicily in the middle part of the 3rd century BC. And so Rome had a long experience with dealing with sort of Greek cities. But the Greek cities in Italy were joined to the Roman polity through roads and through other networks. And Rome felt that because there was, a land border with those territories, it needed to control them directly through either direct effective control or through an alliance structure. But it didn't want anything to do with the Greek peninsula. And that was in large part because the groups in charge and the kingdoms in charge in Greece were militarily significant. They were hard to defeat. And these are the heirs of Alexander the Great. I mean, the Macedonian kingdom is, Alexander's old kingdom. And Romans didn't really want to deal with populations like the population of Sparta or the Macedonians. It would if it had to. And Rome did, defeat Sparta, and it did defeat the Macedonians. But it didn't want to do that because the benefits were not worth the cost.
I'm speaking with Edward J. Watts, whose book, Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny, is published by Basic Books. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. What marked the end of the Roman Republic, and is it linked to some degree with the growth of the empire?
So the story of the end of the Roman Republic is one of those stories where the changes that ultimately result in the fall of the Republic, they take a very long time. And they aren't really noticed at the moment when they start.
So there's no single event that historians take as a landmark?
Well, there is a moment where you can say it's over. And this is the Battle of Actium, where the future Emperor Augustus defeats Mark Antony. And at that point, Augustus is in charge. And he's in charge of the Mediterranean-wide empire. But it took Rome a very long time to get there. And I think this is the thing that we as historians sort of struggle with when we talk about a republic ending. There's in a sense two models for this. And one is the Roman model, where the republic is so strong and so robust that it takes the better part of a century for it to unravel. And the other is the sort of Weimar model, where the republic is quite young and it doesn't have very strong defenses. And, it disappears very soon after it appears. And so when we look at the end of the Republic, there is a moment where it clearly is over, and this is the Battle of Actium. But what sort of gets you from this robust consensus building and very sort of strong and integrated Republic to the collapse is a process that grows out of Rome's empire and the socioeconomic changes that are caused by rapid imperial expansion. But the system is strong enough that it can sort of weather this. People are invested enough in the success of the Republic that all of the socioeconomic challenges that go along with expansion and imperial sort of administration are managed, and people have faith that they will be managed. But eventually, the Republic is not able to actually deal with these stresses. It takes the better part of a century, but eventually these stresses do undo the Republic.
Where does Julius Caesar figure in this this change from republic to tyranny? Because he precedes Augustus Caesar, but he's already engaging in the equivalent of little mini civil wars, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, so I think when you look at the sort of final, I guess you could call it the death spiral of the Republic, there's sort of three figures who are integral in this process, and each of them sort of does a different version of the I alone can fix it model of governing. And the first of these is Pompey the Great in the 50s. And in the 50s BC, Rome is hit by waves of political violence that prevent elections from being held. And Pompey is brought in as basically the person who can stabilize things enough to calm the situation. And Pompey comes in and he does stabilize things and he holds elections. But it sets up a principle of the Republic is only safe if a sort of big man is governing it and is sort of guaranteeing its stability. What Caesar does in the 40s is something similar to what Pompey did in the 50s. there's a moment where Pompey and Caesar, for almost a decade, Pompey and Caesar are political allies. But in the end, the last year of the 50s into 49 BC, there is a division that opens between Pompey and Caesar that ultimately results in Caesar feeling like he needs to send his army to march on Rome, lest Pompey will attack him and ultimately kill him. And so Caesar launches a civil war that he wins. And Caesar's model after he wins that civil war is a version of what Pompey was doing, where Caesar basically says, I can guarantee stability in Rome. I'm the only person who can do this. And I'm going to come up with a structure that will allow this to be sort of a perpetual thing where I guarantee the security of the state. But he does allow for elections. He vets the candidates who will be elected, but he allows for elections. And he allows for something that looks vaguely like a republic in terms of its offices, though there's no question that Caesar's in charge. And this step, you know, ultimately leads to his assassination, but it, again, paves the groundwork for Augustus to effectively say, Rome needs one person in charge, and this veneer of a republic is something that, you know, it can exist in theory, but I'm not even going to go as far as Caesar and pretend that there's something functional going on here. It's just going to exist as a veneer, and I'm in charge forever.
Didn't mobs and political competitors sometimes kill Roman politicians who'd failed, as they did with Julius Caesar? Was that a kind of a brutal form of impeachment?
Mobs did kill Roman politicians, but they didn't usually kill politicians as prominent as Caesar. The assassination of Caesar is actually quite remarkable because it's done in the Senate by senators. It's not actually done by a mob of regular Romans. It's almost a one-off in Roman history. The last time something like that had happened was almost 400 years before Caesar, before the Republic had sort of created a monopoly on political decision-making that excluded violence from political conflict. And so Caesar's assassination is something that's really quite different because it's done by politicians who claim they're doing this out of political principle. And when you had assassinations before, it tended to be mobs armed with clubs or knives who attack someone in public and, you know, manage to do them in that way. But Caesar was done in the Senate chamber by a mob of senators who came armed with knives with the express intent of killing him. And so there's something unique about that.
Although we have had situations in our Congress where one senator, for example, started beating another senator, although nobody ever was killed.
But I
can see parallels in the 19th century. How did Octavius become Augustus Caesar? He was Julius's adopted son. So were there dynasties of wealth and power in ancient Rome?
There were dynasties, but these tended to be dynasties that had electoral advantages. You know, you were the son of someone who had held the highest office in Rome, and you inherited the political network that this person had built or maintained, and so you were able to campaign as his sort of heir. What Caesar did was actually somewhat different, and I think it's important for us as you know, figures 2,000 years distant, understand how unlikely it was that Octavian would actually succeed in doing what he did. Caesar had no male children of his own, at least legitimate male children of his own. And so when he was appointing heirs, he appointed a couple of family members, with Octavian the most prominent. But what Caesar had hoped to do was, in essence, train Octavian. He had no idea that he would die in 44 BC. He was relatively young at that point. He was in his 50s. And I think Caesar expected to live for at least another 10 years. And at the time Caesar was assassinated, Octavian was waiting in what's now Albania to meet up with Caesar and follow Caesar on a military campaign so that he could learn how to command an army. But he wasn't ready to sort of step into political life, and he was only 19 years old. So it wasn't even possible for him to hold office in the Roman state. And when Caesar died, Caesar's will named Octavian as his successor and put a provision that Octavian must now be known as Julius Caesar. But Octavian's only asset at that moment was the name. And what Octavian was able to do was continually leverage his status as Caesar's heir to build more and more of a following, and ultimately a military following, within the city of Rome. But it is by no means a sort of foregone conclusion that that would work. And when Caesar's will was actually announced, Octavian's own mother said, don't accept the will. Just be a private citizen. She didn't see it working out for him. She actually imagined that he would end up dead. And by rights, that was the more likely outcome.
How did he become Augustus Caesar?
Well, what Octavian was able to do was play an incredibly savvy and vicious political game where he marginalized all of the people who were opponents of him, and understood very well how to play a public relations game, leveraging that idea that he was Caesar's heir to continually put his opponents in difficult political positions and then ultimately put them in difficult military positions. So he starts out as the only politician willing to defend Caesar's legacy and prosecute his murderers. Everybody else looked for some sort of a compromise. This ultimately leads him into an alliance with some of Caesar's other former allies, and they defeat Brutus and Cassius in a civil war. Octavian then is able to take the forces of Brutus and Cassius and integrate them into his army, ultimately leading to his defeat of Antony nearly 15 years later.
In 22 BC, a Roman mob threatened to burn the Senate house and demanded that Augustus accept the title of dictator.
Yeah, and this is, again, the vicious genius of Augustus. When Antony was defeated and Augustus took over the last territories that had been loyal to Antony, this is in 30 BC, and he works out a political settlement that more or less sort of defines his power in traditional ways, but in ways that will not be sort of shaken. But there's a dynamic in Roman political life that is, I think, in some ways familiar to us. And people basically get sick of their sovereign after a certain amount of time. And by the mid-20s, people in Italy had gotten sick of Augustus. And this is a problem for him because he's in his 40s. You know, he's a young man. He's basically only 40 years old. He has a long time still to live. And he has to figure this situation out. And what he realizes is there is the possibility, again, of taking this position that he alone secures things in the city of Rome. And what he does is he leaves Rome and he allows things to basically go to hell for a little while. He allows people to see that without him there, there are food shortages, there's political violence, there are disasters. You know, the flooding of the city happens twice while Augustus is kind of holding back. And he orchestrates it so that the people ask for him to come back as a way to kind of solve this near itch problem that confronts every Roman monarch. You know, parenthetically, if you look in the empire at the emperors who get assassinated, a lot of them get assassinated very quickly, but the ones who make it through about 4 years, they tend to be safe until they get to somewhere between 10 to 12 years into their reign. And then there's a whole other batch of people who get assassinated. And this is what Augustus is really confronting in the early 20s, or in the late 20s. People are tired of him.
So how good a leader did he prove to be, despite the opposition?
He is one of the few political figures who's a very successful civil warrior and also someone who manages to figure out a way to sort of govern effectively after the war ends. He's a vicious civil warrior. He engages in wholesale massacres and thefts of property. But once the civil war is over, he's able to pivot so that he can create a governing structure that preserves stability. And he actually manages to govern the empire quite well. You know, there's an economic boom that follows the peace that Augustus sets up. He manages foreign affairs in such a way that there are no real significant threats to the empire that he doesn't manage. And it's, generally speaking, a very sort of safe and productive time once the civil wars are over. And this is quite rare. You know, you don't usually see people who are able to both be incredibly vicious in a civil conflict and find a way to govern and create a kind of governing consensus after that conflict is over.
Did the Romans call it the Pax Romana at the time?
They did, and Augustus was very, very careful to emphasize this. And so there's an altar of Augustan peace that's built in what is the Campus Martius. And right now, if you go to the city of Rome and you kind of cross the bridge from the Vatican, you'll see the altar of Augustan peace. And this is something he advertised on his coins. It's something that he advertised in his propaganda. He advertised it visually in statues. The thing that he promised above all else was peace and stability, and he largely delivered on that. But that was, in essence, his political brand. Was after, you know, all of the violence and destruction of the civil wars that ended the Republic, he promised the stability and a peacefulness that was dependent upon individuals giving up political freedom to him. It was a deal, and his brand was, I will provide peace and security for you if you basically step back and let me run affairs in the way that I want.
Sounds kind of contemporary. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large, talking with Edward J. Watts, professor at the University of California, San Diego, and author of Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny from Basic Books. Under democratic or autocratic governments, how did Rome administer its enormous territory before there were modern communications and transportation?
What Rome was able to do was come up with a mechanism that outsourced a lot of the responsibilities for governing these provinces to provincial governors who were Roman, but ultimately to provincial subjects who governed most of their own affairs. The Republic was slightly different from the Empire, because in the Republic, provincial governorships effectively offered an opportunity for extortion to the senators who were put in charge of provinces. And so in the last, say, 40 or 50 years of the Republic, you see senators get sort of put into provinces, and they pay off all of the debts that they had accumulated during their political campaigns by extorting sort of excessive tax money from the provinces. What Augustus does is he doesn't change the structure. Senators are still put in charge of provinces, but he does basically provide an effective mechanism for provincials to appeal and say this governor is stealing too much money from us.
So there was a positive side to his becoming the autocratic ruler.
There's a positive side if you live in the provinces. There's positive sides for people in Italy as well, largely related to the promise of peace. But if you live in one of the provinces, there's a real tangible benefit, because now your governor is accountable to somebody. And so if your governor really is corrupt, you can appeal to the emperor, and the emperor will potentially punish him. And what Augustus then sort of does is an additional step, where he effectively says to people in the provinces, you run your affairs in your city. As long as you pay taxes and you, you know, more or less follow the rules that we set, we're not going to interfere in what you want to do. And this creates a sort of consensus among most of the prominent people in most of the cities across the Mediterranean that Roman rule actually doesn't change all that much. You know, it provides security. They're no longer providing troops. They're no longer paying for armies. They're, in essence, sort of living under a Roman protective military cocoon. And they run their own affairs, and it's good for them to have an empire in which there's, you know, this sort of autonomy that's guaranteed by the emperor, and they're free from the kind of depredations of corrupt Republican governors.
But there must have been unhappiness on other levels, because in 134 BC, Tiberius Gracchus proposed land reform, secret ballots were proposed, the democratization of the military. It caused a lot of trouble.
Yeah. And this actually, as we were talking about earlier, this actually is the sort of negative outcome of the empire. You know, when the Republic starts building these territories abroad, a lot of the tax money that's coming in is the collection of this is arranged by having companies and corporations and sort of incorporated groups of tax collectors bidding on the tax that they will collect in these provinces. And they have to pay the money up front. And so these people take out massive loans that then, in a way that is not dissimilar from how, say, the subprime mortgage market developed, these loans are then bundled and then resold through the Roman economy. And when you move through the 160s and 150s, you see certain people in the Roman economy immediately understanding what the consequences of finance are, that it's very easy to build a massive amount of wealth very quickly.
So a politician might have said, it's the economy, stupid?
Exactly. Well, that is what they're actually saying in the 140s and 130s. Because this sort of growth of a super wealthy is occurring at the same time that the relative financial position and then economic position of most people in Italy is getting a little bit worse. Because there has been a sort of demographic recovery from the Second Punic War that meant that there was a generation of people who, regardless of their skill level, tended to do better than their parents. But the children of that generation tended to do worse than their parents. And there's a tremendous amount of discontent that's made worse by the fact that they're looking around their cities and they're seeing these super wealthy people who are doing better than anyone in Roman history has ever done. And so it very much is the economy, stupid, but almost not in a Clintonian way, but in a kind of 2016 way, where the economy just looks unfair. And there's a real sort of push in the 130s to do something about it, for someone to just do something about it.
Well, when Tiberius Gracchus made his proposals, that put him at war with the Senate. But you get a feeling that today he would be considered a populist.
Yeah, I think what you would see, I think actually it's not hard to imagine Tiberius Gracchus doing some of the things that Trump did in 2016. What Tiberius Gracchus basically realized was there is this tremendous economic uncertainty and unease that people in Rome are feeling. And it's not an unease that anyone can really effectively and comprehensively address, but you can take symbolic steps and you can start to address it. And because it's sat sort of unaddressed for almost a generation, that matters a great deal. But the frustration level is so high that people are willing to they're willing to accept unconventional and norm-breaking political steps if it is seen as, you know, just making a dent in this sort of unfair economic situation. And what Tiberius Gracchus does is he runs a campaign that proposes reforms, and when the reforms are blocked by the Senate, he then starts intimating, you know, threatening sort of things and threats of violence and associating himself with, like, big sort of crowds of goons. And he never actually uses violence, but it's clear that violence is an option that he's sort of putting out there. And he does push through a land reform that ultimately would benefit maybe a couple thousand, maybe 10,000 people if it was implemented, in a population of a few million in Italy.
Because I assume most people worked in agriculture. This is before the Industrial Revolution.
Lots of people worked in agriculture, but the economic stresses of the middle part of the second century meant that a lot of people in Italy are actually moving to the city of Rome as well. And so the city of Rome, that is probably 100,000 people in the third century, will become a million by the middle of the first century BC. And Tiberius Gracchus is operating at a time when the population of Rome is growing dramatically because people don't feel like they can make it on the farms anymore. Now, it's not 19th century England, but it is a really profound shift in the way that Italians are living. And, you know, and he is responding to that in a substantial way.
Did Rome have a formal constitution as the U.S. has?
It didn't have a formal document that lays out the various sort of obligations and structures that elements of the Republic had. But it does have a sort of running system of laws that govern the way that certain people are supposed to behave. Most of the principles that govern political behavior in the Republic are defined by political norms. And this is in some ways not dissimilar to the way that our system works as well. The Constitution lays out quite a bit about how various forms of government are supposed to interact, or various elements of the government are supposed to interact with each other. But then there are also sort of conventions about how in practice that works. You know, the filibuster is a great example of this. It's not in the Constitution, but there has been a basic understanding that you use it in this kind of way for this kind of purpose. And really, it should be rare when there is real division and the issue is really sort of structurally significant and you need to find compromise. Then Rome had similar sort of mechanisms where they were legally not exactly binding, but there were conventions that said that this is the spectrum in which you can behave. And legally you might be able to do something different, but you shouldn't, because there's a purpose to this particular mechanism. And if you misuse it, that creates problems.
Political scientists often stress that the United States is a republic and not a direct democracy in which everyone votes on individual policies. Did the Romans recognize that distinction?
Very much so.
And they also made a formal distinction between elite and commoner.
Yeah. But the idea of direct democracy is something that it is there when the republic is set up. You know, the Athenian democracy is roughly contemporaneous with the Roman Republic. And it is a political option when the republic is founded. They could have gone in the direction of direct democracy. They choose not to. And part of why they chose not to is because the people leading the revolution that leads to the republic wouldn't have wanted that. But I think part of the reason no one ever really wants to take Rome in that direction is because they sense that what you get in a republic is something that is more deliberative. And with a direct democracy in Athens, you have policies that sort of shift wildly based on just the sort of persuasive power of an individual speaker in an assembly.
Alcibiades and people like that.
Exactly. Yeah, and Romans didn't want that. What Romans wanted instead was a principle, you know, a constitution or a structure that operated under the idea that it's better to do nothing than to do something that passes by one vote or two votes.
Did the founding fathers, Jefferson, Madison, for example, think that Roman example was a good one to follow? Because there are so many other parallels. For example, Rome had a huge slave population.
Yeah. Yeah. And that obviously was something in their minds as well. I mean, the direct democracies in the ancient world also had slave populations. But when the Republic was set up, Rome's slave population was relatively small. But what Rome was able to do was maintain this sort of republican structure while that slave population ballooned and became quite substantial. And so there definitely was an awareness, I think, among the founding fathers that this was a structure that could, you know, it could work for the particular conditions of the 18th century American state. I think they also were very strongly invested in this idea that what you need to do is find compromises and generate consensus before you moved on a policy. And this was the genius of the Roman Republic. The Republic was all about creating mechanisms to facilitate compromises. And you see this throughout Roman society in the 5th century, 4th century, 3rd century, and even 2nd century BC. The ultimate goal of every Roman politician when the Republic was thriving was to come up with a policy that could generate enough support that it wouldn't be blocked. And if it was blocked, come up with some way to generate a consensus or a compromise that would overcome that block. And I think the founding fathers of the United States understood that the North and the South, the Catholic colonies and the Protestant colonies, they all had a very different set of objectives and ideas. And you needed to find a structure that would allow them to come up with mechanisms to reach compromises and develop consensuses behind policies. Because otherwise, there's just too much diversity between the colonies to make the system function.
Did that extend across the Roman Empire or only in Rome itself?
The focus on consensus building, one of the great geniuses of the Roman, I guess the Roman story, extending from the Republic through the Empire, is unlike almost all ancient societies, Rome was a society that would extend citizenship to people who didn't have it. And so what starts out as a city-state by the first century BC has extended citizenship to everybody who lives in Italy. You know, this is something that was not done in the ancient world. When Athens had its empire in the 5th century BC, there were Athenian citizens, and then there were subjects of the empire. But subjects of the empire didn't become Athenian citizens. And what Rome was able to do, or willing to do, was make new Romans out of people who weren't originally Roman. And by the end of the Republic, that included all Italians. By, say, the 1st century AD, this included all Italians, all people in what's now sort of northern Italy and southern France, and large segments of populations all across the Mediterranean who were given citizenship. And that principle of creating a political structure where the voices of these citizens were represented, this was something that was quite important in the Republic. And it's something that the empire had to kind of adapt to and integrate into its structure as well.
But you discuss growing inequality in Rome in the century before the Republic failed. What role did money play in Roman politics? And I'm thinking about someone like Cato the Elder, who is a darling of American conservatives. Wasn't he enormously wealthy, and didn't that give him a lot of clout?
So money becomes an increasingly corrosive factor in Roman politics as you move from the 2nd century into the 1st century. Cato the Elder is at the sort of beginning of this. And Cato the Elder is one of the first Romans who we can see quite clearly understood what finance meant. You know, what this sort of revolution in kind of credit and the sale of loans actually meant, and how you could make money doing this. And we know that Cato, starting in probably the 160s and into the 150s, has developed an incredibly diverse sort of investment portfolio that's designed to basically sort of hedge against any kind of things that might threaten his landholdings. So he has farms, but he also invests in commercial activities. He sells loans. He sort of creates corporations that he is a sort of shareholder in, and then sort of spins out the interest that he sold in those corporations to generate more corporations. It's not yet a moment where this is something that can swing elections. It's still new. But what Cato sort of is able to show us is that people did understand what finance meant, and they understood how to get fabulously wealthy very quickly by creating a sophisticated sort of investment strategy. As you move into the 140s, the 130s, and then sort of into the last sort of century of the Republic, what you see is people who have mastered the art of making money begin pouring this money into political campaigns. And the people who have this money start out-competing the people who just have old money. You know, they have a nice estate, or they have a nice sort of family farm. They have to start taking out loans to sort of match the expenditures of these people who can essentially, you know, write a check.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and that proves extremely destabilizing, because if you've taken out loans to run a political campaign, you somehow have to make the money back. And if you lose elections, you can't make that money back.
Well, Augustus used some of his own wealth to quell dissatisfaction. But what concerns did Romans have about inequality? Was there anything like the debate that we have in this country? And were there abolitionists, for example? Were there any concerns about slavery?
So there are concerns about slavery.
Because there were slave rebellions. We know about Spartacus.
Yeah, and the concerns there are not about the principle of slavery. I don't know of any Roman who says the principle of slavery is wrong. You know, even early Christians aren't really saying that. But the idea that there are too many slaves, and that the sort of slave economy that Rome's conquests are creating is a problem, is something that you see in Roman sources, where they complain about economies of sort of scale in farming, where large slave-staffed plantations can out-compete small landholders. This really becomes a problem in the first century BC. And the rebellion of Spartacus, of course, fits right into that. You know, this rebellion is in the 70s BC. And that really does become an issue of, you know, how do you maintain stability in a society where, in some cases, slaves are agricultural slaves, or they're sort of people shunted out into doing, like, very dangerous work in the mines. But other slaves actually are prominent figures. You know, they're teachers or they're doctors. They have a kind of claim to a level of sort of social capital where, even though they're not free, free Romans can look at these non-free Romans and feel somewhat resentful. And that's a feature that I think is very hard for us to understand, because that's not really something that we associate with the American experience of slavery.
What happened when Rome became Christian? Did things change, or were the things that we've been discussing pretty much, did they just go on as usual?
The Christianization of the Roman Empire happens slowly, and then it happens all at once. And the first Christian emperor is the Emperor Constantine. Mm-hmm. He very clearly is a Christian after about 313 AD. At the time of his conversion, the empire is perhaps 10% Christian. By the time he dies, it's maybe 30% Christian. He dies in 337. It probably reaches a Christian majority in maybe the 360s, 370s. But what effectively happens is, you know, the empire of the 4th century AD is very different from the empire of Augustus. But the people who are becoming Christian tend to be invested in the functioning of the empire. And so there are Christian radicals, people who really do feel like the empire is corrupt and any sort of participation in it is just not Christian. But there's not very many of them, and they have a loud voice, but they don't really seem to persuade anybody. And so the Christianization of the empire is something that has implications for religion, but it doesn't really have implications for how the empire is going to work as a sort of political entity. And it certainly has no implications at all for slavery, or really for economics. The first century BC shows a great disparity in the wealth between the super wealthy and everybody else. But the fourth century AD, in some ways, this is even more pronounced, because the super wealthy are now scattered across the empire. You know, they're everywhere. They're not just in Italy. And they, too, make some lip service, or pay some lip service, to the idea that they have an obligation to spend their money effectively. But they're not campaigning for political office. Instead, they're occasionally spending money on churches or giving money to sort of charities. But for the most part, the Christianization of the empire basically sort of changes religious identifications, but it doesn't change the way that people are functioning in that society.
We're pretty much out of time, but I wonder if there's a single lesson that we should take from the descent of Rome into tyranny.
I think that the one lesson I think that's most important to take away from this is it's very dangerous to assume that the future will look like the past. You know, I think that this is something that we see many times in Roman history, where the Roman state, both the Republic and the Empire, is so successful for so long that when things start going wrong, Romans assume that they're going to correct themselves somehow. You know, that there's a kind of natural momentum and a problem that you see emerging, like wealth inequality in the second century BC, or political violence in the first century BC, or even the sort of advent of barbarian sort of military forces inside Roman territory in the 5th century AD. There's just an assumption that because Rome has been successful, this will get dealt with somehow. But it's the obligation of everybody in that society to deal with it. And if you are sort of complacent about the eternal success of your society, you've basically guaranteed that it will not be successful eternally. And the danger, I think, is to condition yourself as a citizen of a society that has been quite successful to really think seriously about the implications of what's going on around you and where they might lead, not based on where your society has been, but where it's likely to go. And the great failing of Romans living under the Republic was they couldn't conceive of there not being a free and engaged Republic. they couldn't conceive of something like Augustus happening until something like Augustus mm-hmm. did happen. But there has to be a sort of continued vigilance to maintain the integrity of the systems that have been successful and that we value. And as moderns, you know, we need to continually engage in a process of saying, is what's happening conducive to the continued success of what we value? And if it's not, we need to stand up and change it.
Edward J. Watts is an award-winning historian, a professor at the University of California, San Diego. And his latest book is Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. It's from Basic Books. Thank you so much for being on our show. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Professor Edward J. Watts, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.